This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. It's been a war of astonishing moments. Stealth bombers flying over mule trains, horseback escapes and helicopter assaults, burqas and daisy cutters and the American Taliban. Tonight, we look back with Roan Tempest and Sebastian Younger on unforgettable moments in the Afghan war. But first, the latest from Kabul. Earlier today, I spoke with David Rode, a reporter with the New York Times. I asked him how Hamid Karzai, the leader of the interim government in Afghanistan, was received yesterday on his tour of the capital.
He was surprisingly well received. The day was primarily him going to various meetings. He was escorted around by the commander of the Northern Alliance, General Fahim, who's an ethnic Tajik. Karzai is an ethnic Pashtun. But the ethnic Tajik leadership here seems to be going out of its way to pay respect to him and treat him well. While at the same time, Karzai has been, he's limited his statement to the press and to the public, and he seems to be deferring to President Rabbani, the outgoing president, who in this new government will basically have no power. So they all seem to be treating each other very respectfully and at least publicly, so far, so good.
Is this an early sign, then, that the interim government may be able to function despite the many factions under its umbrella?
I think it will in the short term. The problem will be once it's established on December 22nd, they're going to be able to sort of bring control to outlying regions, to governors or warlords out in those areas. Will they abide by the central government's authority or not? I think the rough plan here of members of the government of the UN is to try to establish it first in Kabul and make Kabul into a really strong example of the economic aid that can come in here, what you get for essentially abiding by this government, trying to establish some kind of rule of law, trying to have some ethnic tolerance here, and hopefully that'll spread outside of the city.
David, we all saw the images of celebration in the streets of Kabul when the Taliban retreated from the capital. What is Kabul like today?
It's very calm, and one of the surprising things that's happened here is that there's been almost no revenge attacks on at least people who are known to be Taliban. What's really striking is that average people continue to voice almost unanimously support for a multi-ethnic government, that average people are desperate for an international peace force. Some of the militias and political leaders with troops don't want one, but the people here are desperate for it. So it continues to be upbeat. One thing that's changed is there's some desperation in terms of more and more people it seems economically are struggling for money, and there's been some food distributions here that have been sort of swarmed with people trying to get food. So it's important for the government to get operating to start supporting people.
You wrote a piece earlier this week about the Ghazni Hospital. Could you describe what you saw there?
We had gone into the hospital in Ghazni, which is about 100 miles south of Kabul, but it sits in sort of a no-man's land that isn't controlled by the Northern Alliance or former Taliban soldiers. And we went in there and found 8 women and children that had been really injured in an American bombing on Sunday morning.
What was the number you said, David?
There were 8 women and children. There was a 6-year-old girl whose spinal cord had been severed by a piece of shrapnel. There was one woman who was laying on a bed, essentially groaning with each breath. She had abdominal wounds. And on 2 beds in the same ward were 2 of her children. Her son had his leg broken by shrapnel, and his daughter had shrapnel hit her in the head. The doctor spoke sort of broken English, but he said her brain is outside.
Do you have a sense that this is a scene repeated across Afghanistan or a rare situation?
I wouldn't say it's rare, but I wouldn't say it's widespread either. I think there's precision bombing. American jets are hitting the targets they want. We spoke with the Pentagon, and they confirmed this village, but they said it was a confirmed al-Qaeda base. All I saw were women and children. There were no military there. They said some military passed through that area, some retreating Taliban. So I think it happens. It's not widespread, but it's a price that it happens. A lot of innocent people are hurt here.
From your time on the story, David, what do you think will stick longest in your memory? What scene or image?
I would say the first day in Kabul, and there was one image of a man. He'd gone. It was outside one of the police stations, the religious police stations here in Kabul, and he had gotten hold of one of the whips that the police used to use to women who didn't have their veils on or men whose beards were too short. And he was holding in the air and leading the crowd in a chant of death to Mullah Omar. And it was a dramatic scene. And for many, it seems like that day. And that's what leaps in my mind most.
David Rode is a reporter with the New York Times. He spoke with me earlier today from Kabul. In the midst of the chaos of war, journalists keep filing. And in this war, the scenes have been stranger than Star Wars and as sharp as the cries of a wounded child. Tonight, we're talking with writers who were there on the front lines, looking back on a war like no other. Which story from Afghanistan has touched you most? Which image will never leave you? What questions do you still want to ask the reporters who were there? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Sebastian Junger recently returned from Afghanistan, where he was a correspondent for ABC News. His new book, Fire, is a collection of stories about people confronting situations that could destroy them. He joins us from the studios of KPCC in Pasadena, California. Hello, Sebastian Junger.
Hello.
And Rhone Tempest is here. He's a senior California correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, was a foreign correspondent for 17 years and returned to Afghanistan for 2 months to cover the war. He joins us from Davis, California. Hello, Rhone Tempest.
How are you?
We're well, thanks. Also with us tonight from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is special coverage news analyst Jack Beatty, a senior editor with the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
So, Sebastian Junger, Rhone Tempest, thanks for joining us tonight. We know you've both been out and you're both back. The wired world means that we all see images and have seen a million and astonishing images from Afghanistan, but we're hoping that you'll settle into your notebooks and memories with us a little bit tonight and help us feel this war, bring us the vignettes that stick with you most. Sebastian Junger, I guess the first question on a lot of people's minds is, what does it simply feel like to arrive in Afghanistan? How do you get there, and what does coming in feel like? Is there a different smell? Is there a different light? What's the sense when Afghanistan first hits you?
Well, it's definitely unmistakably Afghanistan when you get there. The last two times I've been there, a year ago and then just recently, I went in by helicopter from Tajikistan. Mm-hmm. And we flew into the Panjshir Valley, one of the most beautiful places I've ever seen. It's just gorgeous blue ribbon of water going through an alpine valley, just absolutely stunning. And everything is dusty there. I mean, that's like the first one of the first
photos all show that dun colored desert and dust everywhere.
Yeah, and the Panjshir is a little bit less, but even there, it's a powder almost like moon dust or something. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely extraordinary stuff. Very few cars, a big sky, and the light is the most remarkable thing for me. Maybe it's the light. It's just this strange clarity to it. It really, the whole world kind of glows, particularly towards the end of the day. It's just an indescribably beautiful land.
Is it the altitude?
I don't know what it is.
You have to be a meteorologist, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, also, just the visual images with the people. I mean, I don't know. I'm not a photographer, but I think it must be just a paradise for a photographer. Everywhere you look, everything you see is just visually dramatic. I mean, like the fighters, the Northern Alliance fighters with their guns and their RPGs, they always seem to be silhouetted against the skyline, you know. And the mist is always coming up off the river in the morning, and it just incredible sights in every direction.
Rhone Tempest, you spent many years in South Asia. I remember years ago when Indira Gandhi was assassinated, actually working out of your LA Times offices for an afternoon. I thank you for that favor even now. But so you know the entire area, India and Pakistan. When you know that you're going to Afghanistan, is there something different about that as a destination?
Well, I think, yes, it's historically it's been the crossroads and for South Asia. And for me in particular, I was there from 84 to 88, as you recall, based in New Delhi, but spent a lot of time both in Pakistan and in Afghanistan on both sides, both the Soviet-controlled side and in some of the Mujahideen areas. So it's a special place that's always been marked by conflict, and it was very interesting for me to go back after so many years and note the contrast. The last time I was there was in 88. I rode out on Soviet tanks. I was part of the initial withdrawal of the Soviet troops, and I rode out on a tank and on an AP armored personnel carrier from Mazar, went across the Friendship Bridge into Termez. I remember At that time, there was a woman waiting on the other side in her wedding dress. She was the wife of a Soviet soldier, and she wanted to show him that her love was just as strong as it was when he went off to war.
What a vision. Roan Tempest, how did this war feel different, this experience, this time?
Well, the country's been even more battered. I mean, it really looks like a bruised and battered place. There's been a lot of overriding about the carcasses of tanks and so on, but it's just a scarred and bruised place, and it's poorer than I ever recall it being. Its infrastructure is devastated. So to me, it was sadder than it has been in the past. There's always been, as Sebastian mentioned, there's always been the sort of unparalleled beauty of the place.
Mm-hmm.
But and with the other aspects of life there, the tremendous politeness and courtesy of the culture and so on, it masked its other problems. This time, I think the poverty was a lot more evident, and the problems of the place and the ruined landscape.
Sebastian Junger, what's your history with Afghanistan? How long have you been going?
I went there for the first time in August 1996.
Mm-hmm.
I'd been assigned a story on some Westerners who'd been kidnapped in Kashmir. And I told my editor that the real story actually was in Afghanistan. A lot of the militants in Kashmir have fought in Afghanistan or were trained there.
Mm-hmm.
And that I should really do an article also on the terrorist training camps. And I was in Jalalabad in August 96 and then in Kabul. And within weeks of my departure, the Taliban took over those cities and much more of the country. I went back just a year ago. Now, I spent a month with Ahmad Shah Massoud, who, as you probably know, was the leader of the Northern Alliance.
Mm-hmm. Charismatic, young, photogenic, and now assassinated.
Yeah, and a real master tactician. He caused the Soviets tremendous problems in the 80s and were causing the Taliban the same sorts of problems. He was badly outnumbered by the Taliban, but they could not dislodge him. And I spent a month off and on with him as he waged war against the Taliban, trying to open up his supply lines before winter set in. Just an extraordinary experience. I mean, he really basically was surrounded in the mountains, and we went in by helicopter, and an amazing experience. And very sadly, he was killed on September 9. And my reasons for going back this time were really tragic. But I was glad to go back. It's a very important country to me.
Jack Beatty, it's been an incredible, intense war, but also an incredibly short war. How do you think it will linger in Americans' minds?
Well, I think there'll be conflicting images. I certainly think that Americans are going to think with some pride of the women casting off their burqas and with the feeling mm-hmm. that Afghanistan had been liberated from this terrible government and that the other images, the images of the broken bodies in the hospitals and so on that we've seen, and the refugees, those images will also be there. And I think Americans will be working out a kind of calculus that maybe the good will outweigh the bad, in that with this evil government gone and people can have a better life. But so much depends on what happens next and on the capability and justice of this new government.
Roan Tempest, we just have 20 seconds before the break, but the women, we want to come back and talk about the women. Just give us, in a nutshell, do you think there's a better future for them now?
I don't think there can be any doubt about that. But they are the key, I think, to a key measurement of how Afghanistan does.
We're going to come back after a short break to pick the brains and the notebooks and the memories of Sebastian Junger and Roan Tempest, both back from Afghanistan, from a war like no other. What images, what moments stick with you from the war there? What will you never forget? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or get into the conversation online at WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. It's only lasted a little more than 10 weeks. What images do you still not understand? And if we had a ticket to Kabul for you tonight, would you take it? What would you expect to find when you got there? I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about memories of a war like no other, the war in Afghanistan. It's not over yet, but it's clearly in its last days, maybe even hours. We're talking with Sebastian Junger, author of The Perfect Storm and a new book, Fire, about people in dangerous situations, and with Roan Tempest, a veteran foreign correspondent with the Los Angeles Times who spent a lot of time in South Asia. Both of these guys were recently in Afghanistan. Both have their memories now, as we all do from TV. Theirs come with the smells and the sounds and the reality attached. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. What images, what moments stick with you from the war in Afghanistan? Sebastian Junger, Roan Tempest, we want to just tick down through the categories and hope you'll settle into your memories with us here. The soldiers, the civilians, the women, the children. Afghan soldiers, they, on both sides, they had a kind of theatrical quality to them in the way they dressed, in their bearing, in the way they stare at the camera. Sebastian Junger, what are your memories of these fighting men on both sides?
Well, I think probably the most powerful memory I have from this last trip was we got word the night before the offensive towards Kabul started. We got word the night before that it was going to happen in the morning. We got up before dawn and drove out to the highway, such as it was, leading towards Kabul, right at the front. We got there, the sun was just rising, and hundreds of Northern Alliance soldiers had driven forward in old Soviet pickup trucks. Mm. We got there just as they were climbing down from their trucks, and they lined up on the highway, and the sun was just touching their faces as it was rising, and they opened their hands towards the sky, and they prayed. And one of the commander led them in a prayer. This beautiful, beautiful morning, absolute silence on the desert. Mm. And then one of them sang a song. I have no idea what it was, but it was absolutely heartbreaking and beautiful. And there was just a moment of silence after he finished, and then they all jumped in the trucks and roared forward towards the front to attack. It was an unbelievable moment.
Was it a moment of prayer to prepare for battle, or was it one of in a routine of daily prayer, Sebastian Junger?
No, this was a special prayer. They were not kneeling towards Mecca. Mm-hmm. They were standing. They're standing with their palms towards the sky, and praying. I think for the protection of God and for this whole thing to go well. Mm.
Roan Tempest, what about the religiosity of soldiers with the Taliban and in the Northern Alliance? How apparent was it? How we've heard the radio communications back and forth, the name of Allah is often raised. You've been around the region. Was this a conflict where the name of God was often in the ears and on the lips of people?
Well, I think that you have to compare that. Sebastian was in northern Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. He was in the presence of a more organized military force, and I was coming in from the south into Jalalabad, a place that had just been evacuated by the Taliban.
You came in from Pakistan through the Khyber Pass then?
Through the Khyber Pass, mm-hmm. Yeah. It was a pretty dramatic entry. Mm-hmm. And the difference is that they had to create some kind of military force, mostly imported. Some fighters came down from Nuristan. Others were tribal fighters loyal to one commander. Others trekked across from Pakistan. So there wasn't a unified feeling to the place. Mm-hmm. I'd say that the difference between now and 14 years ago is that these fighters don't know much more than a kind of basic religion and war. Whereas before, you could be surprised at the depth and learning and experience of a lot of the original Mujahideen. Mm. So I think it's just these decades of war have also eroded the... I mean, in the old days, you would be very likely to hear people recite poetry, sing songs, perhaps like the one Sebastian's mentioned, but have a deeper, broader culture. Some people mm-hmm. might have university educations, but still be fighting with the Mujahideen.
We're capturing the images, the moments of an extraordinary war tonight, the war in Afghanistan, perhaps almost over now. What images, what moments stick with you from this war? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Jack Beattie, you've been reading Sebastian Junger's work from the region and Roan Tempest. What questions come to your mind?
Well, I had one for Roan Tempest, actually, in a dispatch he does about the killing of the four journalists at a bridge. It's on a trip, I gather, from Jalalabad to Kabul. These journalists were stopped, and they were removed from the cars, and they were killed. And in his piece, he says a reporter for the Los Angeles Times was in the convoy, but just 200 yards behind. And because the drivers of the vehicles in which the journalists were carried ran away, it signaled the rest of the convoy that there was trouble ahead. I'm just curious, were you that journalist, Mr. Sabas?
I'm afraid I was. Yes, I was.
So you were within 200 yards of the fate of these four
right.
journalists.
We took off from Jalalabad on our way to Kabul, and people had been making that trek the previous 2 days with no trouble. I was fortunate to be in the fourth car instead of the second or the fifth car instead of the second and third cars where the journalists were killed. It was one of the closer calls.
Did you know these journalists?
I knew them by sight. I like a lot of things that happen in these war type settings. I had just jumped onto the convoy as it was moving out, so I really didn't know head or tail of it. I just knew that the van that I was jumping into had an empty seat. I later learned that I knew a lot of people on the convoy. I knew these particular journalists just because I'd seen them around.
An Italian, a Spaniard, and of course the two journalists with Reuters.
Right.
It was a bad day. Sebastian Junger, what about the reception in the post-Soviet invasion and expulsion period of the sudden invasion of foreign journalists? How were you received 1,000 years ago, or 25 to be exact? I had my life saved in the hospital in Kabul by Afghan nurses who treated me very well, but a lot has gone down in the country since then. What does it feel like to show up on the scene being an American journalist? What's the reception?
Well, the Afghans, I suppose, unless you're invading them, are just excruciatingly polite and displaying just an incredible hospitality. So whether you're a journalist or just a visitor or a traveler, they really are very, very kind and will offer you food and, do you need anything? Can I help you? This time we were there to cover, of course, the American bombing and the subsequent ground war, and there certainly was an appreciation expressed by the soldiers about what the Americans were doing. It was very clear. You could sit on a rooftop and watch these tremendous American bombs hitting the front lines a few miles away, and it was very clear that if the war was going to change, if the Northern Alliance was going to take Kabul, it would. The reasons for that were obvious, and they knew it, and we knew it. Mm-hmm. They would also, of course, talk about September 11, and they were sympathetic the way anyone in the world would be. But they also, they didn't quite say this, but they sort of implied it a little bit. Basically, we've been at war for 20 years. Now you people in America have experienced it. Welcome to the human race. I mean, this is how it is. You have been the exception in having been spared that kind of terror, and now you know what it's like too.
Welcome to our world.
Exactly.
We're talking about the Afghan War, Memories of an Extraordinary War, with Sebastian Junger and Roan Tempest. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Eric is on the line. Hi, Eric. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is this. Most of the feedback I hear about the Afghans, it comes through the government and through the fighters. What do the regular, normal Afghan citizens think of America? What do they think of this war going on? And sort of a secondary question that I might throw in would be, what about the children? Are they the only hope left in Afghanistan?
Thanks for your call, Eric. Roan Tempest, Sebastian Junger has touched on this, but what's your view of how Afghans viewed this entire war effort and the American presence?
Well, I continue to be astonished at the amazing reservoir of hope that exists in this country, Afghanistan. I watched Jalalabad evolve from a place that had been under very strict Taliban control into a place that became accustomed to having 200, 300 foreign journalists wandering around its streets. I worry about the country and its new generation. I think that the whole generation of leadership has been sacrificed. I did a story about one family in which the four brothers had all received higher education, were all dedicated to public service as educators or doctors and administrators. The next generation didn't get education. The next generation after that is problematic, probably doesn't even live in Afghanistan. So we also witnessed the birth of a child. And you just have to wonder, you have to hope that other countries will be there to help the place. And
where was that birth from, Tempest?
It was in Jalalabad. Another reporter, correspondent for the LA Times, Megan Stack, had befriended an Afghan family and spent a lot of time. And when the time for the child to be born came, we were at the house, and we welcomed the child into the house. It was a very moving experience, but it certainly brought home the point about what is the future for this child.
Yeah. Sebastian Junger, we've seen the images of the children once again free to fly kites in Kabul. What are the images of children that stick in your minds out of this scene of conflict?
Well, some of them are very beautiful. Some of them are really disturbing. Last year when I was there, I was in a refugee camp, and I'm not a doctor, but it was clear that these kids were so sick. You know, they all had skin diseases, and they were just dirty and sick, and some of them were dying. I grew up in a nice town in America, and I had a nice childhood, and I don't know. You can't see that and not ask yourself the question, why them and not me?
Yeah.
But on the other hand, going into Kabul, I got into the Kabul the very first morning that it fell, and children were flying kites. There was one wonderful kid who bicycled by playing a harmonica, something he hadn't been able to do since at least August 1996. Mm-hmm. And everything they were doing, all the things they couldn't do for 5 years, they were doing all of those things as fast as they could.
There's an image
of freedom.
Amazing
time.
Yeah. Jack Beatty, jump in with us. You've seen the images like us all. They provoke so many questions. Our guests have been there.
They do. Now, the New York Times had several reports from a hospital in Jalalabad just last week, where the first casualties from bombing, inadvertent collateral damage from Tora Bora were brought there, and the doctors really sounded angry. It was a note of, yes, we understand why this is happening, but why are these people here? What are you doing, America? Did you hear much of that?
Over the collateral damage.
Yeah.
Roan, Sebastian?
Yeah, well, I think you have to understand that in that part of Afghanistan, the Pashtun part of it, the people who are there, the commanders who are pretenders to power or who are in position to take power once the new order is established, they don't need, I mean, to them, these kind of civilian casualties only cause problems. And since they're now allied with the U.S. effort, I think it poses political problems for them. They're angry and they express their anger. They go out of their way to express their anger in part because they want to show that they're not endorsing that part of the war, I think.
Sebastian Junger, the women of Afghanistan have elicited so much empathy and curiosity and concern around the world. What did you see with burqa and behind the burqa? What's the circumstance? You saw them when the Taliban was fully in charge, and you saw them when it was ousted. Give us a sense of their lives.
Well, actually, I wasn't in. I was never in Taliban-controlled territory, but in Northern Alliance territory, wearing of the burqa was also very, very common. And an important point, though, it wasn't enforced by law. It was not enforced by the government. It was a question of
culture.
Culture and tradition, exactly. Which for me, there's an enormous difference between that and a regime that would enforce it literally by force.
Well, just talk to us about that burqa then for a second. How did you see women wearing it in an area where it wasn't enforced? Did they always have it on when they went outside? Was it older women, younger women? Did they treat it as a fashion accessory? Could they take it on and off at will in the market?
Well, most of them wore it, and occasionally you'd see particularly an older woman who didn't have it on, but if there were strange men around, in other words, foreign journalists, she would cover her face. I talked to a woman in a hospital who did not wear one at all, a very sophisticated woman from Kabul, a refugee. And that's part of my point, that the wearing of the burqa seemed to correspond maybe to the level of education and sophistication of the women, and certainly to the security of the situation. What women have said, not to me, but I've heard from other women, Western journalists who have talked to Afghan women, that often they choose to wear the burqa and would prefer to because it's a lawless, occasionally chaotic country, and they don't want to be the subject of perhaps violent male attention.
Right.
A strange twist on the situation that I never really would have thought of.
You say you got that from other Western journalists. Were Afghan women really difficult for male Western journalists to communicate with, to talk to, in general?
Yes. This woman in the hospital who was very sophisticated and had no problem talking with us, but certainly in the street, you really couldn't speak with Afghan women if you were a man. Absolutely no way.
Rome Tempest, sorry, Sebastian.
They would just get shy and back up, and the men sometimes would get a little uncomfortable. They just made sure it didn't happen.
Yeah. Rome Tempest, is there a moment, an image, a memory of Afghan women dealing with their circumstances that sticks with you?
Well, first of all, I think that there's a number of Afghan women who are the unsung heroes or little sung heroes of this whole conflict. First of all, for raising international attention to some of the policies of the Taliban. Secondly, through organizations like the Revolutionary Association of Women of Afghanistan, undercover, you know, there's been so much attention paid to all of the refugee camps and the training camps and the cradles of conflict. But there's also been a lot of very courageous women who have gone into Afghanistan, who have conducted underground schools, who have photographed some of the activities of the Taliban. So when it comes to women, I think it's the women that I met, not in Afghanistan, but in neighboring Pakistan, who had been part of this underground movement.
The exiles, the refugees.
I went to what was essentially, you could describe as a training camp for women. A feminist training camp, they had gone in on many missions. They had an orphanage there. The girls who were in the orphanage intended to go in and work with Afghan women.
Women really diving in. Rome Tempest, Sebastian Junger, we've got to take a break. We're talking about images, memories of the Afghan war. It's nearly over. What do you remember? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about memories of an Afghan war, of the Afghan war that Americans know from the last 10 weeks, a war really like no other. Our guests tonight are Sebastian Junger and Rome Tempest. You can join the conversation as well. We're at 1-800-423-8255. What will you never forget about the war in Afghanistan? Michael is on the line. Welcome. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi. The thing I remember most is that everything my father told me about fighting the Pathans came true.
Pathans, Pashtuns in American English?
Pashtuns in American English.
He was there with the British Army?
He was there with the British Army from 35 to 39, and I grew up hearing tales about fighting them, and I grew to respect, you know, as he did.
So when it burst into your living room on the television, did it look like the images you had in your childhood memories?
Well, I learned it with the Russian. It was reinforced when the Russians went in. It was reinforced when they left. And, you know, I said, yes, you were telling me the right things that you told me when I was a child. And everything I saw on television. You know, even this evening, even yesterday evening, I saw what is known to my father as a sanger, you know, the stones were piled up so that people could get inside. You can't dig down into the ground.
Mm-hmm.
You have to pile the stones up as protection.
Again. Kind of a foxhole without a hole.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, the things he told me, you know, came true again and again. When I did a conversion, when people started talking about warlords, I converted back to clan leaders because those are the things that were very important to those people in that time,
Yeah, Michael, thanks for your memory. Sebastian Junger, what about this? We heard again and again about the history of fierce fighting in Afghanistan, the Pashtuns and others, and yet the war ended so quickly. How do you put those historical images together with the facts of what happened this time?
Yeah, I think it caught a lot of people by surprise, me included. The Taliban were really propped up by not only Pakistan but bin Laden and his network. And the effect of the bombing was absolutely devastating on the front lines, apparently. I spoke with Northern Alliance commanders and even some Taliban prisoners. And after a few weeks, the command structure really broke down.
Mm-hmm.
The Pakistani advisors pulled out, apparently, so as not to cause political problems.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, you really had inexperienced volunteers on the front lines with very little direction. In other words, the Taliban, even before the front lines were broken, had basically given up. Once Mazar-e-Sharif fell in the north, which was a vicious fight, once that fell, they basically gave up. But so it wasn't a battle so much as
a retreat.
A retreat, yeah. I mean, the Northern Alliance just sort of bulldozed through. I mean, certainly there was fighting, but it wasn't the kind of pitched battle that everyone was braced for.
Roan Tempest, our time is running down. Paint for us one last picture. What will stick in your mind from this war in Afghanistan?
I think coming through the Khyber Pass at sunset, and like the gentleman said, all of these historical images that I think, I still think the greatest writer on this region is Kipling.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're coming through, you see the signs, you see the forts of the Khyber Rifles, you see the sun setting, you go through that dark gate. There's almost no electricity. You see the shadows of men and guns.
It's time travel.
You enter into a city that's almost in complete darkness. You go to an old palace that was once the summer palace of the king. There's an impromptu press conference, and a man announces that he's the new governor of this province.
In the year 2001.
Yeah.
And Sebastian Junger, what about you? Paint us a last picture. What will stick with you from the war in Afghanistan?
I think it would have to be the moment that the Northern Alliance broke through the front lines. We were with the first tanks that went through on the highway, and it was starting to get dark. There were these red streaks in the sky over our heads of rockets firing and hundreds of men coming in off the rugged land on either side of the road, coming onto the road and hugging each other and kissing each other on the road in celebration of the breakthrough. And the headlights of the tanks were projecting the shadows of the men onto the smoke, almost like an old black and white movie. You could see the little orange tips of their cigarettes, and this convoy was just hurtling towards Kabul in a moment that all of the journalists knew was absolutely, we were watching history.
This was it.
This was it. It was happening, and it was extraordinary.
Sebastian Junger, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
Sebastian Junger was a correspondent for ABC News in Afghanistan. His new collection of stories about people confronting dangers that could destroy them is called Fire. And Roan Tempest, thank you for being with us.
You're welcome. Enjoyed it.
Roan Tempest was a foreign correspondent for the LA Times for 17 years. He's now senior California correspondent for the LA Times. Jack Beatty, they've brought back images of war. It's in a new kind of war. The Afghans' famed fighting power couldn't stand up to B-52s, but there was still a lot to witness.
There was, and in one of his articles, Sebastian tells of a dream he had after being bombed, and the dream was that a bomb was coming down on him, but he deflected the bomb, and it went on to a family that was having a picnic, and he felt very, very guilty when he woke up, but had saved himself somehow.
So, Doctor, how do you interpret that dream?
I can't practice over the air here.
You know, Jack, These guys will all bring these images home, but it's also interesting how it is an information age, and everybody who's watched a television also has images. Everyone who's seen those vivid color pictures in the newspaper today, these days, as opposed to just 10 or 15 years ago, also has images from this war. It's personal at the same time as we like to hear it from the people who were there. We each have our own memories that will stick.
Yeah, we do. And there are things, of course, that we can't see. We can't see the hunger. We can't see the disorder. We can't see the, you know, the gelling of a consensus to move forward. We hope it's there. But the things that we've seen, yeah, these are images to last a long time.
I remember you responding to just the written word of the boy who had lost his hands and his sight.
Yeah.
That's a memory that doesn't go away quickly.
That's quite a price to pay for the liberation of a country, I guess.
But it's paid. Jack, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. Tonight, we continue our series with the Project for Muslim Understanding. Six Muslim PhD candidates from across the country have come together since the terrorist attacks on America to analyze global trends which contributed to the events of September 11th. Joining us now is Waleed Al-Ansari. He's a PhD candidate in the Human Sciences Program at George Washington University. His paper is entitled The Economics of Terrorism, How Worldview Can Alter the Rules of the Game. Welcome, Waleed Al-Ansari.
Thank you, Tom.
Right off the top, I have to say I loved your paper, but explain for all of us, what is game theory in a nutshell?
Well, game theory is like looking at the world as if it was a chess game and looking to see the different strategies that people are using in playing that game and using that understanding to determine our own strategy.
Okay, so let's look at September 11th and the terrorist who attacked on that day, let's say Osama bin Laden and his crew. As you interpret it, as an economist and a game theorist, what were the rules of the game that Osama bin Laden was playing by in planning and executing September 11?
Well, I think the key to understanding Osama bin Laden's strategy was really clear from his first videotape statement that he made on Al Jazeera the very day that the United States started attacking the Taliban. He began his statement by saying that the United States is now experiencing the same kind of fear that Palestinians and others have experienced for a while, and closed his statement by saying that the United States Americans will not feel safe until the Palestinians feel safe. So to a game theorist, that's obviously a tit-for-tat strategy.
It sounds simple, but it has a lot of ramifications. You're saying his fundamental strategy is tit-for-tat, meaning he will hit the U.S., in a way that the U.S. has to pay in some way. And you point out in your paper that really this terrorist attack had a million-to-one payoff, for just about $1 million of cost to the U.S. for every $1 the terrorists had to spend, in addition to their lives, to pull off the attack.
That's correct. Bin Laden basically believes, he does not believe that the United States will respond to moral arguments. And therefore, the only way to get the United States to change its foreign policy is if they change the costs and benefits of the foreign policy.
So tit-for-tat is a very bottom-line-oriented strategy. He's betting that the U.S. will respond to a bottom-line problem. But the thing that permitted him to pull off these attacks was the willingness of his terrorist actors to die in the process. Now, you're also Muslim, and you bring an understanding of Islam to this. How does that factor in to Osama bin Laden's ability to recruit these suicide terrorists?
Obviously, with a suicide attack, there are no material payoffs for the guys who are, you know, doing the attack. So therefore, there have to be spiritual payoffs. Now, bin Laden has inverted those Islamic doctrine of the idea of sacrificing oneself for God, because that sacrifice is only acceptable when it is done in a just way. I mean, that sacrifice cannot involve hurting innocent third parties, innocent American civilians. And as a matter of fact, the Islamic doctrines on warfare, or regulations regarding warfare, forbid the use of fire against your enemy. So, for example, an explosion such as the World Trade Center or nuclear bombs are out. It also forbids poisoning the well of your opponents. So chemical and germ warfare are out.
And you point out at a very fundamental level that Islam is not a religion in which the end can justify the means.
Yes, absolutely.
So what bin Laden then has done, you're saying, is he's blended a very secular agenda with a kind of veneer of Islamic language and perverted thinking.
That's right, and it could not work under any scenario. What's very important to the self-understanding of the suicide attackers is that the United States initiated this with an unjust foreign policy. Otherwise, there wouldn't be any spiritual payoffs for them from the attack.
Now, the United States has responded to this with a large military response in Afghanistan. That response has generally so far been seen in the U.S. as successful, in as much as it has routed the Taliban. It hasn't yet caught Osama bin Laden. How would you assess, in game theory terms, by your analysis, the success to date of this U.S. military response?
Yes, actually, you know, in many respects, it has been successful. This taking out of the terrorists was, in game theory terms, a first step in whatever scenario that they would attempt to pursue. The key, though, is what do we do after this? Mm-hmm. Is that military solution, so-called we eliminate terrorism by eliminating those terrorists, is it going to work by itself, or do we need to complement that with other steps? And I think that's a very important factor that we need to consider.
I would assume from your paper that you would say that we won't fix it long-term unless we address the foreign policy complaints that are represented by the terrorists.
Yes, because basically bin Laden's strategy of the, you know, tit-for-tat, million-to-one cost-benefit ratio has, in a sense, proven itself in the minds of would-be terrorists. And by the way, I think basically most Arabs could easily understand, you know, the logic of bin Laden's strategy. For some reason, many of the media experts didn't really give it that type of attention.
It was labeled very widely as insane in the United States.
Yeah, exactly. They viewed it almost as if it was irrational, that suicide terrorism is irrational, therefore there could be no underlying strategy.
So then, in your game theory analysis, what would be the most effective way for the U.S. To respond to this challenge that would be not only effective but would be in line with its own morals as well, assuming that bin Laden is not correct, that there is no morality in U.S. foreign policy?
Right. Well, I think the number one thing to do would be to do something in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict that would be perceived as just by the Arab street. And as a Muslim, I feel that that would also be a fair policy.
But that's exactly the goal that no one's ever been able to achieve in all these decades of Israeli-Palestinian relations. So what is the way out of this, Waleed Al-Ansari?
Yeah, the only way out of a tit-for-tat scenario where both sides are attacking the other and claiming that the other started it first and retaliating is basically for one of the sides to mount a Gandhi-style peace offensive that challenges the self-understanding of the other side. And so I really think that's the only way that the Palestinians can solve this.
So game theory leads us to Mahatma Gandhi.
Yes,
we'll see. It would be beautiful if it could happen. Waleed Al-Ansari, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Waleed Al-Ansari is a PhD candidate in the Human Sciences Program at George Washington University. His paper is entitled The Economics of Terrorism: How Worldview Can Alter the Rules of the Game. To see how Al Jazeera Arab Satellite Television is covering the events in Afghanistan and the Middle East, go to our website, wbur.org, and click on Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR in Boston.
This is